Call to order. I call to order this December 1st, 2025 special meeting. Roll call.
Mayor DePue.
Present.
Councilwoman Gillis.
Here.
Councilman Thomas.
Here.
Councilwoman Dalbo.
Here.
Councilman Rainbird.
Here.
City Manager Mahoney.
Here.
City Attorney Wolf.
Here.
Interim City Clerk Tupin present.
Item 2, presentation, proclamations. Item 2A, presentation by Joan Edmond regarding the Stormwater Master Plan. We're going to have a presentation, and if anybody in the audience has any question, it is this one time going to be open dialogue. I ask that you don't ask more than two questions, and please keep it to less than 8 minutes. Thank you. Okay, Joan Edmond.
Good evening, Council. Can you hear me all right? My name is Jared Hernese with Jones Edmonds. I'm a senior project manager. Also got Brett Cunningham with Jones Edmonds with me and Chris Fagerstrom from Mead and Hunt. And we're gonna go through the presentation. Quick agenda here. We're gonna review the draft Stormwater Master Plan findings and recommendations. And then as the mayor said, we're gonna have public comment and questions following that. I'll take us halfway through the presentation and then Chris is gonna take over and wrap it up for us. So, jumping into the project, I want to give this overview of the tasks. These are the primary tasks that were completed for the Stormwater Master Plan. We've got data collection, stormwater model development, flood protection level of service, problem area identification, improvement alternatives analysis, and capital improvement plan. We're going to go into more detail on each of these tasks in the presentation. Getting started with data collection, this is really the first task in the process. The goal of this task is to collect data for the stormwater model development and evaluation. There's really two branches of data collection. You've got the desktop data collection, which is the first one, basically finding any existing digital data that needs to be used for the stormwater model development and evaluation of the process. Things like existing stormwater studies and models, we can take data from those and use them for this update. We've got the 2018 LiDAR digital elevation model, so that's the surface, the digital surface that all of the modeling is based on. I'm not gonna go through each of these, but all this data is used as we move through the process of completing a stormwater master plan. So the next part of the data collection task is the field data collection. So anything we're not able to find through digital data, existing digital data, we have to go out in the field and collect that data. So we visited over 1,100 locations in the field, mostly for the stormwater features. So we visited channel cross sections, stormwater collection systems, cross culverts, pond outfall structures, any of the primary collection systems and features in the stormwater system we visited and inventoried that we didn't have existing data for. So when we're at these locations, we collected data including invert elevations. So we have X, Y, and Z data. Size and shape of the structures, if it's a pipe, what size is it, what shape is it, material, is it concrete, is it metal, maintenance condition, and photographs of each location. So you can see some examples on the right here. The top right photo is of a pipe across culvert where we collected information on each end of that culvert. Hard to see the text, it's a little small, but we collected all that information listed there in that second list of bullets. Similarly, on the bottom photograph, we've got pipe information on the upstream and downstream end of cross culverts. And there's also little X's in there where there's cross-section data that was collected across that ditch on the upstream and downstream side of the culvert. So once all the data collection was complete, the next step was to develop the stormwater model. The stormwater model is a tool for characterizing existing flooding conditions. Then once we understand what the existing flooding conditions look like and how the system operates, we're able to use the model to test and develop improvement alternatives. So what can the city do to help improve drainage and help reduce flooding within the city? The model is highly detailed. You can see these examples, the example photographs shown on here of the model schematic. And there's a blow-up section taken from the Florida Shores area where you can get a closer look at how much detail is included in that model. Another thing to note is that it extends well beyond the city's limits. We go all the way down to the Indian River Lagoon on the south end and all the way up to State Road 44 on the north end. So we're really capturing those boundary conditions and making sure the model is reflective of how those are impacting drainage within the city. Once we have the initial stormwater model developed, the next step is to verify that the model has accurate results. So we all know that the city has experienced some extreme flooding, extreme storms in the recent past. The table in the middle here summarizes a few of those. We've got Hurricane Ian, September 14th, 2024 then, and the Hurricane Milton event. The table summarizes the rainfall depths, the rainfall duration, and then also the approximate return period for those events. So you can see, you know, the smallest one was Hurricane Ian from a return period perspective, which was a 25 to 50 year return period storm. The other two were between a 200 and 500 year storm. So these are extreme rainfall events that the city has experienced. So the two that are shown in the red box, we use those to verify the model results against observed flooding. So we took those rainfall distributions, plugged them into the model that was developed, and simulated the storm in the model, and then mapped the simulated inundation extents. So on the left is an example of this from the September 14th event. You can see the picture of the flooding on the top of that figure. And then on the bottom, you can see the blue shaded areas. Those are representative of the modeled inundation extents. So then you can also see there's a little yellow arrow pointing from where the photograph was taken across the street. Might be a little hard to see there. You can see that it's looking towards those homes on the west side of Yoli Tree Drive. And you can see that, you know, the one home is surrounded by the flooding in the photograph. And then you can also see that's shown in the blue inundation areas on the bottom. And then on the right, you can see an example from the Hurricane Milton inundation. So again, we modeled Hurricane Milton using the stormwater model, and then mapped the inundation in the blue areas, and then compared that to the inundation that was seen in reality in the photograph. And they compared very well. So we feel good about the model results for the city. So once we had a verified model, we were comfortable with the results. We went ahead and modeled the design storm events. So we modeled five design storm events, including the mean annual, which is essentially a two-year return period event, 10-year, 25-year, 100-year, and 500-year design storm events. And you can see in the table the rainfall depths that are associated with those events. It can be a little misleading when we say 100-year event. That doesn't mean that it happens once every 100 years. It could happen tomorrow, and then it could happen again a week from now. That just means it has a 1% chance in any year of happening. So that's something to keep in mind. And then once we modeled these events, we went ahead and plotted the inundation areas again. You can see those shown on the right. That's for the whole city, the 100-year inundation extent. And then you can see a blown-up version of that and the yellow in Florida Shores, what that inundation looks like. So the next step, once we have all that inundation, all those simulations completed and mapped, next step is the flood protection level of service. This essentially tells us how well are you protecting from flooding under existing conditions, and where are your existing problem areas, your most severe flooding problem areas. So for this task, we identified structure, residential yard, and roadway flooding for each of those design storm events up to the 100-year event, because that's what the city's level of service is based on. And those three categories were taken from the city's level of service standards, which are shown in the box on the left, bottom left. Those reference street flooding, residential yard, and structure flooding. So as part of this process, we came up with a prioritization for the model subbasins, which is shown on the right. And I'll go into more detail on those individual categories in a second. But you can see the prioritization that came out of it, the level of service on the right. So you can see those areas that are shown in red and yellow and orange are your worst, your highest priority areas, I should say. And then the ones in the green, and light green or not shaded at all, those are the lower priority areas. So going into a little more detail on each of those. So this table summarizes the finished floor elevation or the building flooding that came out of the level of service analysis. So we looked at two categories for this. So we looked at flooding that would be above a finished floor elevation and flooding below a finished floor elevation, but it still touches the 100-year floodplain. And then obviously there are several where there was no building flooding. So the table breaks that out by design storm event for the 10, 25, and 100-year event. So you can see in a 100-year event, we would expect about 610 homes to have flooding above a finished floor elevation in the city. And then the figure on the right shows those 610 locations symbolized based on the storm event that they begin to flood in. So ones in red begin flooding in a 2-year event, ones in yellow begin in a 10-year, and so on. Moving on to the residential yard flooding, similar breakdown here. We've got four different categories for this one. We looked at yard flooding between 0 and 33% of the yard, yard flooding between 33 and 66%, and then 66% to 100%. And you can see the breakdowns for the individual storm events. And similarly to the last slide, we've got the photograph or the figure on the right showing the results from that. Basically anywhere that yard flooding was greater than 33% in the city with the same symbology. So the red yards have greater than 33% starting in the 2-year storm event. And the last category was the roads. So for this one, we designated road flooding that was greater than 6 inches and also less than 6 inches. So you can see here what that breakdown looks like. So for a 100-year storm event, you've got 990 roads with greater than 6 inches of flooding on them. And then you can see the breakdown on the right. Again, ones in red begin flooding, having that 6 inches of flooding or greater beginning in the 2-year storm, and so on. So once we had the level of service analysis completed, the next task was identifying the problem areas. So for this task, we identified 25 problem areas throughout the city. You can see them shown in the figure on the right. They're in blue outlines, maybe a little tricky to see, but I'll go into more detail on several of these in the next few slides. So the table here shows the four columns on the right show the number of homes flooding or projected to flood. I guess buildings, not necessarily just homes. Buildings that would be expected to flood in the 100-year, 25-year, 10-year, and 2-year events. And then we also prioritize these as tier 1, tier 2, or tier 3 problem areas. And that was mainly based on those level of service analysis results. So where you have more homes or buildings being flooded, those are typically in the higher tiers. This is just the rest of the 25 problem areas. So then we ended up grouping the tier 1 and tier 2 problem areas into 6 areas, mostly based on geography or hydraulic connectivity. So a lot of these areas have drainage systems that work together or impact one another. So we went ahead and grouped them into these six groups. So the first one is the Florida Shores south of Indian River Boulevard area. That was problem areas 1000, 1009, 1006, and 1022. It's basically everything in Florida Shores south of Indian River Boulevard and east. There's a ridge that I forget what road it is on. East of that ridge. Then you have Florida Shores north of Indian River Boulevard, basically anything in Florida Shores north of Indian River Boulevard, which is problem areas 1003, 1010, and 1013. Florida Shores west, on the west side of the Florida Shores. Edgewater Acres, there was two problem areas that were combined there. That's up around the wastewater treatment facility. And then the G2 and G11 canal problem areas were combined. And then you've got the Pelican West problem area, which is kind of off on its own. So I'm gonna go through each of those areas in a little more detail, show some results from the analysis, and talk a little bit about what might be causing the flooding in those areas. So starting off with Florida Shores South, again, this is Florida Shores south of Indian River Boulevard. So the figure on the right shows what the 100-year inundation extent looks like in that area. The table to the top left, you can see in the bottom, that's the total number of buildings that have flooding above the finished floor elevation for each of those storm events. So in a 100-year storm event, we would expect 374 homes to have flooding above the finished floor elevation in there. The table on the bottom left shows the volume of surface flooding for the 25-year and 100-year events. So for example, there's 403 acre feet of volume outside of existing stormwater ponds and ditches that are on the surface in this area. That's equivalent to 100 acres, if you think about 100 acres, with 4 feet of depth of water on it, or 200 Olympic-sized swimming pools of water on the surface. So what are the drivers for this flooding that the city's seen in this area? The big thing is the four recent storm events that were all at a 25 or 50 year greater return period storm. Another thing is that Florida Shores was developed in the 50s and 60s prior to modern stormwater regulations and design standards. So the existing drainage system was designed before you had to provide a certain amount of retention volume and designed to certain design storm events. Typically, you're designing now for a 25 or 50 year design storm event. Back then, there was no standards that made you design to those. So as a product of that, there's very limited stormwater pond storage capacity in this area. Typically for new developments, we see 15 to 20% of the area reserved for stormwater ponds in a new development. For Florida Shores, in this Florida Shores South area, it makes up about 1,300 acres. This would equate to about 195 to 260 acres of stormwater pond that would be designed in this area if it was developed today. Currently, there's about 36 acres, total acres, of stormwater pond in here. So there's a big, there's a lot of storage volume missing in this area. Also, you've got limited hydraulic capacity. A lot of the ditches and culverts in here were designed to drain historic wetlands or as mosquito control ditches. They were not designed to handle 50-year, 100-year design storm event flows. You've also got several topographic challenges in this area. You've got ridges on every side of the area, east, northeast, south, and west, topographic high spots, and in the middle, you've got essentially a bowl where there's a low. So all the water is running off into the low area, and it's getting trapped in there. And then the last two are related to continued build out of the Florida Shores area. So as more lots are built out, you've got an ever increasing impervious area in there, which increases the stormwater runoff that's happening. You've also got a loss of storage that's happening when homes come in and they build up. You're losing that surface storage that was there previously for stormwater retention. Wanted to throw these three figures up here to kind of illustrate a few of those points. So the figure on the left is those three problem areas overlaid on the 1950s aerials. And what you'll see in the background in those dark areas, those are wetlands. So those are where wetlands historically were. And then the figure in the middle is the digital elevation model. So to read that figure, you know, those higher areas are shown in the red and white, and then you can see the bold area, the lower areas in the yellow and green shown in there. So you can see there's a ridge on the east side, the west side, the south, and the north with Indian River Boulevard. Then the figure on the right shows a time lapse kind of throughout history as Florida Shores is built out, you know, what that looks like, you know, throughout time with the increasing impervious area and build out in there. So moving into the Florida Shores North area, a very similar slide here as the previous one. So on the right, you've got that area shown with the 100-year flood inundation extents. You've got the table on the top left showing the number of buildings that we'd expect to flood in each of the design storm events. So we'd have 56 in the 100-year storm event. And then again, you've got the bottom left table showing the surface flooding volume in that area. So for a 100-year storm event, we're looking at 132 acre feet, which is a little less than Florida Shores South just because it's a smaller area. So that's equivalent to 33 acres with 4 feet depth of water, or about 65 Olympic-sized swimming pools. So the flooding drivers for this area are very similar for Florida Shores South, just because it was all developed at the same time. The one big difference is the amount of stormwater ponds. So this area is about 420 acres. So this would equate to 63 to 84 acres of stormwater pond. And currently there's about 7 acres of pond in that area. Also similar to Florida Shores South, you know, the same figures here showing where those wetland signatures used to be in this area. And then you can see those correspond to the low areas that you see in the digital elevation model, going in the yellow and green areas. And then you, on the right, you can get an idea of the build-out that's happened in that area over time. So moving to Florida Shores West, same setup here. You've got the yellow inundation area showing the 100-year, 24-hour inundation extent. Table showing finished floor, or the flooding above finished floor elevations. So in this area, we have far less building flooding happening, fortunately. You've only got six homes that are, or six buildings that would be flooding in the 100-year, 24-hour event. And you've also got less surface flooding here as well. So you're talking about 73 acre feet of stormwater on the surface. Pretty much the same as the last area are the flooding drivers. Again, in this area, you're talking about 510 acres. So that equates to 77 to 102 acres of stormwater pond if this were a new development. Currently, there's about 6.5 acres of stormwater pond in this Florida Shores West area. Same figures again. On the left, you've got the 1950 aerials. You can see the wetland signatures in there, which are also corresponding to the low areas shown in the digital elevation model. And then the same one on the right, showing the build-out progression. Moving into Edgewater Acres. So this is the area north of 12th Street, south of Park Avenue, between, I guess, west of the railroad tracks. So in this one, we've got the table, right, so we've got the figure on the right showing the inundation areas for the 100-year 24-hour event, and then the table on the left showing the building flooding as well. Again, flooding drivers. This one's a little slightly different. There's two kind of main differences here that I'll point out. I guess on the bottom, the model is showing that there's a lot of off-site flow coming from south of 12th Street to the north, coming out of the Florida Shores area to the north. So for the 100-year 24-hour event, we're showing about 730 cubic feet per second of water coming out of there to the north. And then you've also got, there's a couple of undersized culvert crossings at Park Avenue and the old railroad tracks that I'll show in a second. Similar figures here. On the left, you've got the 1950 aerials again. And on the right, you've got the digital elevation model. And you can see where wetland signatures are shown, left and right. And they line up well with the model, or I guess the digital elevation model low areas. So this figure illustrates that constriction that the model is showing at Park Avenue and the old railroad track. So what this is showing is the hydraulic grade line along the outfall ditch in this area. So the dashed lines running from left to right are the peak water surface elevations from the model. And then the solid blue line is the surface elevation. So you can see those high points where you've got the jumps up and down. Those are where roadways are crossing those ditches. So you can see the dashed lines, there's a pretty big jump from the right side of Park Avenue to the left side of the old railroad tracks. What that indicates is that there's undersized culverts in this area, so the water can't get out fast enough. Unfortunately, we can't just go in there and make those bigger and solve all the problems, because then you just are forcing the problem, kicking the problem downstream from there. Moving into the G2 G11 canal, same thing again here. And see what the 100-year inundation looks like in this problem area. And then you You've got the table showing the building flooding again. So in this area, we've got building flooding that's starting in the two-year, 24-hour storm, the lowest spots. Again, the flooding drivers are pretty similar to the past. The other areas we've been looking at, I guess the big one here. So we've got the wetland signature shown in the 1950s aerials again. And then you can see the low areas in the DEM. And then again, we show another hydraulic grade line for this area. So you can see where there's those big jumps in those red boxes, where you're going from a higher elevation down to a lower. That's where you've got limited hydraulic capacity in the system. So the last of the problem areas was the Pelican West area. Same setup. Got your 100-year inundation on the right, and then your table showing the number of buildings that would be flooding in the design storm events. So really we were only showing flooding that would happen here, 100-year, 24-hour event. For buildings. Flooding drivers again, very similar. You got the aerials on the left from the 1950s showing the wetlands, and then the DEM showing the low area where a lot of the flooding is happening. And then again, we've got the hydraulic grade line showing along that outfall ditch where we've got areas with large head loss across the stormwater pipes and across the system, which are causing water to back up in the system. So I'm gonna hand it off to Chris.
Thank you, Jared. Council, good afternoon. Appreciate you being here. I'm Chris Fagers from Mead and Hunt. I'm gonna take you through our alternative evaluation and capital project plan development. So first, a little bit about our process in developing our capital improvement plan. You know, we first start off with a preliminary phase where we're looking at really big picture concepts. What's going to move the needle and help improve the situation? So we look at ideas very conceptually, determine what might be limiting the system, what changes might make improvements to figure out what to hone in on. For the conceptual phase, once we've identified some of these projects we think will be beneficial, we start looking at them in through different lenses. So we might extend the channel to one existing channel and then try to extend it to the next and see which one of those alternatives produces the best results. And we start modeling things in these groups of projects to kind of figure out what's going to be effective and move forward. Once we figure out our effective projects, and we start looking at them in a detailed analysis, getting them put into the model in great detail, accurately putting them in, modifying the digital elevation model surface, and then start modeling those improvements at the detailed level. So the last step in this process is really looking at phasing, kind of how the capital improvement plan is going to get laid out. So we start kind of grouping projects together that are going to be effective together, projects that Jared alluded to, some projects you just can't go out and do because they're potentially could create issues downstream of that conveyance improvement. So looking at a sequencing, as you may, that's going to make the projects make sense and not cause any impacts elsewhere. And then we ultimately model our phases as lumped phases, and especially with our future phases, we model those with future conditions like potential sea level rise scenarios. So as part of our analysis, we looked at over 110 different alternatives. And those generally, and Jared's done a great job alluding to some of these things, they can be lumped into two main categories. Improvements in conveyance, being able to move the water quicker, get it out of the system, or storage. So all of our improvements you can see listed here, we've kind of categorized them into those conveyance improvements, like channel improvements, making a channel larger, increasing pipe sizes, looking at problem area pipes. Jerry pointed out a few of the problem area pipes, looking at those could be upsized and improved to make them more effective and efficient. We looked at new outfalls to the river, evaluating new paths to the river at multiple different locations to determine which path might be the most effective or feasible. And then we looked at quite a few pump stations. So pump stations are kind of a conveyance and a storage option. So if we put a pump station on an existing pond, and we're able to draw that pond down, we create additional storage, and then we're also pumping during the storm events to increase that capacity. So that's kind of, the pump stations are that twofold approach. So then going into the straight storage is we looked at multiple different pond locations, and a lot of those made it through to the final cut, and I'll talk about those today. And then kind of some other categories outside of your storage and conveyance, we looked at backflow prevention or tidal gates to prevent those king tides or storm surge from backing up into the system and kind of causing that sunny day type flooding that we could potentially see. Some other improvements that are outside of those categories are we looked at modifying berms to hold water or to release water a little earlier, just kind of some of those things that are out there a little bit that ultimately needed to be evaluated to see if they made sense. So ultimately, we came up with 25 different alternatives that we're recommending today. And they're listed here in our boxes for conveyance and storage improvements. And just some of those improve, you know, multiple channel improvements throughout each of the phases, adding cross connections to allow water to have a different path than the only one path it really has out in Florida Shores. You know, looking at pipe improvements to allow better capacity, and then ultimately some outfalls, then multiple pump stations on, we'll go through each of those, and then ponds where we could apply ponds to try to get the storage volume increase so we could provide that storage that's really desperately needed. And then backflow prevention, we'll talk about some of those as well. So our first phase of our projects, I don't really want to call them low-hanging fruit, but they're relatively low-hanging fruit. Projects that can be either built on vacant city-owned land, projects that work independently and don't require, you know, an upstream improvement to be implemented, projects that are ongoing and are beneficial to the city. I'll touch on one of those. And then lastly, probably the most important thing, the first phase doesn't require property acquisition. So these projects could be move forward with. The individual projects are listed here, and I'll go through each one of those in detail for phase one. So for phase one, we'll start with the first project. This is located in Florida Shores South problem area. There's three existing ponds there, south of 442, just west of the railroad tracks. We're looking at putting a 50 CFS pump station on each of those ponds. That's a relatively large pump station with a force main pumping it all the way to the river. So we're pumping that water out of the system. And as I stated previously, you know, those ponds are relatively small to that pump size. We could draw those ponds down significantly prior to a storm event that we know is coming. And we could have that storage available for runoff to enter those ponds and be stored before it begins to flood. And then they would try to keep up with pumping. They would continue pumping during the storm events, pumping 150 CFS out to the river during a storm event. Our next project is down south of Florida Shores on Volco Road. This is a culvert improvement project. What we're proposing here is two 36-inch RCP culverts going under Volco Road. The wetland to the north of this location is isolated. It doesn't have an outfall. It fills up and then ultimately backs back into Florida Shores along 35th Street. So to help prevent that backup isn't necessarily a source of the flooding, but it does contribute to the flooding, so it should be dealt with. So to implement some culverts at this location would allow it to continue to drain south and follow its natural flow path. And then it would also allow it to drain out during dry periods instead of just holding water constantly like it does now, and then it's easily overtopped and it's flowing into Florida Shores. It'd allow it to draw down and you know, function more appropriately and like it has historically. The next project, this is a busy slide, but this is the G2-G11 project, a problem area for the G2-G11 basin. As Jared mentioned, this basin starts at the very north end of town along 10th Street, runs between the railroad tracks and US 1 all the way down to the YMCA. This project or series of projects is currently ongoing. We're working on designing and going to construction. We split these into two phases, a group A and a group B. Group A will be going to construction first of the year, and then group B will be going to construction later next year. So this project, like I said, is a series of multiple projects. It includes, I like that Jared was showing the profile of that system, how it stages up. So we've increased in culverts throughout the system, culvert sizes to decrease those losses that you were seeing in those in that profile that he showed. We're going to be doing ponds on publicly owned land, on city owned land. So we have four different ponds that we're going to be constructing. And then lastly, we have two pump stations that will be associated with this project to pump out to the river, a 30 CFS pump station and a 15 CFS pump station. The 15 CFS pump station is located on Pine Bluff, and the 30 CFS is located on Pearl Street. So this project is already has money encumbered through a grant, has a grant awarded to it, so it's moving forward independently of the master plan. The next project is another pump station on what I call the Duck Pond, north of 442. This is an existing pond, putting another 50 CFS pump station with a separate force main out to the river. Again, the ability to pump that pond down, it's not a relatively large pond. A 50 CFS pump station would be able to pump that pond down relatively quickly and provide that available storage for an incoming storm and help to be able to store that water before potential flooding occurs. The next project we have here in phase one is the 18th Street Canal improvements. The 18th Street Canal is the main, really, essentially the only outfall from Florida Shores to the east. So this canal takes on, almost 2,000 areas of watershed that drain to this canal. And so this canal, unlike many canals in Edgewater, has available right-of-way. Most canal systems in Edgewater don't have much available right-of-way to expand. But this one, there is some available room to expand the canal. We're looking at expanding it out to a 30-foot wide canal and then replacing. Most of these pipes are 72-inch equivalent pipes or 72-inch pipes, culverts, couple 60s thrown in there in a few locations, but looking at replacing those with large box culverts to really increase the capacity and carrying capacity of that system out to the river. This project also includes a backflow preventer at Riverside Drive or a tide gate, the ability to prevent that storm surge or high tide from backing up into the system and causing flooding. But we do need to improve conveyance as well as prevent that backflow from occurring. So a lot of these projects are working towards improving conveyance. Next project for Edgewater Acres near the wastewater treatment facility is looking at putting a pump station on the existing reuse pond. Again, have the ability to draw that down. The Edgewater Acres neighborhood is limited to its discharge based on it discharging into the reuse pond. That reuse pond stages up, and then it has trouble discharging. So getting that reuse pond lowered will give the community an ability to drain out more effectively and get some of the water out of the neighborhood into the pond more effectively. This project is also associated with the next project. So once we get that pond pumped down, we're going to come back in and concurrently install new culverts or culvert drainage systems within the Edgewater Acres community to make that better connected in there. Right now, most of the water in Edgewater Acres has to flow from north to south all the way to the south end of Edgewater Acres, and then it turns and comes around. It takes a very long circuitous route, and looking to improve that with an updated drainage system to connect that more efficiently over to the pond will help that neighborhood. Next project is a cross connection. I said that the 18th Street is the only outfall really from Florida Shores. There is some area of Florida Shores that drains to the Turnbull Hammock to the west. And so we looked at providing a cross connection from the problem area on the east side of South Florida Shores to that western border, which we call the Silver Palm Ditch, so it can actually have a better secondary discharge point and connection to outfall to the hammock. So this project includes using the 27th Street right-of-way to create a channel and culvert system to connect the existing pond on 27th over to the Silver Palm Ditch to provide another point of relief or another discharge point to help that area drain more effectively. A last project in phase one, this one is again along the Silver Palm Ditch, along the western side of Florida Shores. That ditch system, as I mentioned, outfalls into the Turnbull Hammock. And one thing we noticed throughout the modeling was that as you look at these, where the X's are located, those are existing culverts, and you see significant losses as you step through those, and the water surface elevation gets higher and higher as it backs up through there. So with the previous project connecting over there, if we can remove those culverts and open that ditch up through there, we won't have those significant losses, and it'll make the previous project even more effective. So this project is looking to remove those undersized culverts and put, you know, open it up to be just channeled through there. So kind of in context, just to show you where everything is within the phase one project, this graphic kind of shows the projects geographically, and I'll kind of step through them from top left. So the top left, the ones denoted with a 3 are all the G2, G11 projects, the pump stations, the pipe improvements, the storage ponds. And then if you step down south of Park, the 6s and 7s, the 6 is the pump station on the reuse pond, and then the 7 are the culvert improvement projects and the Edgewater Acres and G5 canal system. Then as we step a little further south into North Florida Shores, the number 4 denotes the Duck Pond pump station improvement. And then the number 5 to the east of that is denotes that the 18th Street Canal, so that canal will be improved from the river or from Riverside Drive all the way back to Traveler Palm. So that would stretch throughout that distance. And going to the next to the image on the right, on the very north part of that slide are the pump station locations for the 3 existing pond pump stations. And then kind of heading down south to that 8 is the location of the 27th Street Canal Improvement Project. The 9s represent the removing of the culverts on the Silver Palm Ditch. And then in the very bottom right-hand corner is a 2 showing the location of the Volco Road culvert locations. So this image shows the inundation. Jared was showing it in a yellow. I'm showing the existing in a dark blue. This is for the 25-year return period. The dark blue is existing and the light blue is proposed. So this first phase, you know, using available land, using pump stations, improving conveyance where we can, really seeks to address more of the 25-year return period flooding. We still get benefits in the 100. We remove 172 buildings from the flooding just in this phase one from flooding during the 100-year. But we get about 67% of the buildings for the 25-year removed from flooding as part of this phase one project, phase one series of projects. So phase two, we start getting into the requirement for property acquisition. We've put these out as our next phase, just mainly due to that fact you're gonna need time to acquire those properties and move those projects forward. Some of these projects need the phase one projects to be in place so we don't create downstream impacts. And these also include a little bit more permitting challenges with multiple permitting agencies going to be engaged with these projects. And some of these projects also supplement projects from phase one. For example, the 27th Street Canal, we're gonna be looking at doing one on 25th and one on 23rd in future phases, so they kind of build on each other. Provided here is the list of the projects included in that phase, and I'll go through a summary of the phase two projects. So for phase two, kind of starting at the north and working south, at the very top of this slide, you see a 3. That location is the location of an approximately 2-acre pond to be located near Canal Road and Mockingbird in the G2 G11 basin. So this would be a project that would provide additional storage in that basin and help to alleviate flooding through providing additional storage. The 5, Jared talked about this already, at Park Avenue in the Edgewater Acres area. Under Park Avenue, that culvert is undersized, and we see significant backup at that location. So the project denoted with a 5 would be upsizing the culverts under Park Avenue and then removing the culverts under the old railroad bed just to the north of Park Avenue. And then moving south a little bit to the number four, that is an existing pond that's located there. It's about a 9-acre pond. We're looking at expanding that out to be a 40-acre pond. It's located just south of the Massey Airpark. We call it the Massey Pond, with a connection from 16th Street over to the existing ditch located near Pine Tree Drive, or Pine Tree, yeah. So that would provide storage and be able to provide a connection for storage over to that larger pond system, providing a 40-acre pond there. So then when you head south of 442, the number one denotes a 30-acre pond in this general area. The red polygon that's our red rectangle that's around that area is about a 250-acre area. So we modeled a 30-acre pond somewhere within that area. It doesn't have to be a contiguous pond. It could be multiple parcels. But we want to get some lumped together to get some decent-sized ponds that could be connected together and still work efficiently and effectively. Additionally, in that area, sliding to the west, is another storage pond denoted by the number two. That's a 10-acre pond on a vacant piece of property that we're proposing, with a connection all the way back over to the mango tree ditch that runs near where the number one is located, and having that connection and storage off to the west there. Moving south from there down to the number six, this is the 25th Street Canal connection over to the Silver Palm Ditch. So that ditch system would provide some interconnectivity and give some ability for the system to drain west more effectively towards the Turnbull Hammock. Then the last project included in phase two is denoted by the seven. It's by the over to the east by Pelican West, and it would be a pond and a new outfall to the river from that pond out to the river, allowing that to discharge out to the river. This doesn't only provide benefit for Pelican West. This, all the water that drains out of that area in and around the Pelican West problem area there has to drain north all the way up to 18th Street and then make its way out. So water that we can take directly out to the river, provide treatment through the pond, take it directly out to the river, is water that doesn't take up capacity in the 18th Street system. So it does provide some benefit to the rest of Florida Shores as well. So looking at the results for this phase project, which is built upon phase one, again, the dark blue is existing, the light blue is proposed conditions. And as part of this phase project, we removed 449 buildings from the 100-year floodplain, making a significant dent in the total number of buildings there. And then, you know, this project will, include all of our phase two projects at this point. So phase three includes additional storage and conveyance to continue supplementing phase one and two. And then some of these projects need phase one and two projects to avoid any downstream impacts as I said previously. So the individual projects are listed here, including box culverts under Indian River Boulevard that would require some additional upstream storage to prevent that downstream impact from occurring. So kind of walking through this one, similarly to the last one, if you start at the very north, the number four denotes a 15-acre pond. It's actually an expansion to a 2-acre pond that's currently proposed with the G2-G11 project, expanding it out to a 17-acre pond. And then that pond, as part of the current G2-G11 project, will have that 30 CFS pump station on it. So it'll be a significant pond in that basin with a 17-acre pond and the 30 CFS pump station pumping out to the river. Coming down to the number five in North Florida Shores, this is another pond to kind of complement the Massey Pond on the west side. We call this the Mango Pond on the east side. This is about a 20-acre pond on the west side, and it also connects over to the Pine Tree ditch system and provides a storage and off of that system to allow it to back up into there and provide storage. The number ones located on Indian River Boulevard are box culvert improvements. There's a significant loss, as Jared was showing, under Indian River Boulevard, backing it up into South Florida Shores. So going in there and improving those culverts, getting them up to an adequate size, box culvert to allow it to have the carrying capacity that it needs, as a recommended project. Then in the polygon again, in phase two, we included the 30-acre pond. Depending on where that pond gets sited, there may need to be some modifications to the pump stations that were in part of phase one. Ideally, it would be an expansion of one of the existing ponds so we can, you know, utilize those same pump stations as part of phase three. But there could be some potential dollars that need to be spent to modify those pump stations. The last two projects in phase three were denoted by the six is our 23rd Street cross connection from the existing existing ditch system over to the Silver Palm Ditch for our third connection there. And then the two denotes a connection from Florida Shores to the new ditch system and outfall that was constructed for Pelican West, creating a secondary outfall to the east and allowing that to discharge through another outfall and not just the 18th Street Canal. So for this project, this phase of the projects, again, you can see the inundation here, or the extent of flooding and existing and proposed conditions in the dark blue and light blue. And with this phase three, we remove 485 projects from the 100-year floodplain. So phase four is really your ultimate resiliency scenario, looking at part of this capital plan asked us to look at out to year 2100, but looking at different time periods and how sea level rise potentially will affect the system and cause, you know, things to be function a little different with that elevated river water level. So phase four really is meant to address that, and it includes potentially large property acquisition, and then these projects are intended to address the flooding associated with that sea level rise scenario. And we have two projects associated with this, a 100-acre pond in Florida Shores, and then a pump stations on the Mango and Massey ponds. So I was previously shown, we were in phases two and three, we proposed ponds on the what we call the Massey and Mango. This phase would include pump stations for those ponds. They're still a little undersized for the area, but this would give us that additional capacity through pumping. And then on the south part of Florida Shores, this polygon's about, that's shown here in red, is about 450 acres. And in that resiliency scenario, looking out 2050, 2060 and beyond, you know, acquiring 100 acres in there and constructing a 100-acre pond would be what you'd need to address that ultimate sea level rise scenario in the future. And then this one, we've modeled it with that future scenario, and we still achieve 496 homes removed from the flooding in the 100-year floodplain. So then in terms of costs, so looking at a phased approach here, our first phase, should be noted that the first phase does not include the cost for G2, G11. That money is already, the city already has that money in the form of a grant. So the total for phase one doesn't include that. The city's moving forward with the G2 independently of this. So for the total for phase one, we're looking at 83 to 121 million. For phase two, which includes the 30-acre pond, we're looking at 43 to 56 million. And then for phase three, we're looking at 20 to 28 million. And then that resiliency scenario, a future scenario with the large pond and pump stations on the new ponds, we're looking at 70 to 100 million. And so for a total cost of $216 to $305 million for capital, capital projects. And it should be noted that this money does not include property acquisition. We don't know where the ponds would be located. So I think that turns us over to questions.
Well, thank you. I think that was a great presentation. It was well needed. I think that there was talked about low-hanging fruit. I mean, when we see that number, of course, it's high. It's not going to happen overnight. It's a plan for several years. Our last one was done in 2014. So I think it's a great start. Should we open it up for citizens' comments first, or would you like to have the council go first?
Might hear citizens. I'd like to
hear the citizens' comments. Let's open it up for citizens' comments and questions at this time.
Oh. Edgewater Chuck, 205 Cherrywood Lane, Edgewater.
Thank you.
Some good information here. Proud to say that after our last council meeting, I proposed my own flood plan. Being an operating engineer, I proposed pumps at the ponds. The Bunker Road canals, I proposed that, the G2 and 11. I didn't hear nothing about cleaning them out. They're clogged up really bad. I've made several videos. You've all seen them. The water's barely flowing. I heard from a council member, I won't mention his name, but he said something about being against the law. Well, I think it should be against the law not to clean them out. We got to get them cleaned out. The duck pond, Mr. Mahoney took care of that, excuse me, put a pump down there, and we proved before, during, and after the pumps do work. Thank you, Mr. Mahoney, again. My plan was simple, affordable. You start at Silver Palm, you clean the canals, all the railroad tracks. You get a couple extra pumps. When the storms come, you pump the lakes down. Drop a steel plate in front of them, the water can't backflow. Simple. That's affordable. That's doable. This other plan here, do you think you're going to take people's homes? Good luck with that. Not that we would ever have the money to do it, but we need results now. You know, we're half a year from the next hurricane season. I mean, this year? How many lifetimes would it take to get the money to do this while we keep flooding over and over and over again? I went and looked at our budget. I found us easily $2 million that we could get up. We could contract, get these things cleaned out. You know, they're not flowing. You know, I've taken you down there, you and you, and you've seen everything that's clogged up, and nothing's been done about it. I'm not saying nothing's done in the works, but they haven't been cleaned out yet. You got to get the canals cleaned out, even before this. I can't stress it enough. Now, Diesel, I went down there to Balco Road after Hurricane Milton. I took a video. I sent it to you. Danny Robbins got one of the water flowing across Balco Road. It's holding all that water back. We got to get them culverts in. I did a video about that. So I'm asking if y'all listen to me. I know what I'm talking about here. That's why I'm running for Edgewater City Council, District 1. The city needs me. I know what I'm talking about. I talked about all this ahead of time, and it didn't cost you $1 million. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'm sure that the city manager can answer the G2, G11 question during his manager report during the routine city council meeting. Okay, and now to council comments. I guess we will open it to one citizen comment again if nobody else rises within 30 seconds of him sitting down.
Mr. Mayor, good evening, Council. Ernie Cox here with Deering Park. And just I did not hear anything in the presentation about anything west of I-95, so I didn't know if it was possible to ask a question that perhaps these folks could let us know if they looked at west of 95.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Cox. I'm sure if they would like to address that now, they certainly can. I think we were going to ask that during the council meeting when it was on the agenda, I'm sure.
Is that in regards to new development or existing problems?
I would say that go ahead and speak about both.
Okay. So I guess it didn't pop up as a priority area under existing conditions because there's very little development over there, so there's no buildings that are flooding, roads that are flooding, or yards. So it wasn't, you know, identified as a priority area under existing conditions. We were asked to model Deering Park, the proposed development. So one of the great things about the stormwater model that the city can use it to review new developments. So we can take that existing conditions model and plug in the proposed conditions, which is what we did for Deering Park specifically. I've got a few slides in anticipation. So yeah, as I mentioned, we took the proposed Deering Park development, plugged it into that existing conditions model to see what the impacts would be downstream of it. So something to note is that, you know, Deering Park is about a 2,000 acre development. 400 acres are being set aside for stormwater ponds and stormwater management. So that's about 21% of the developed area that's being set aside, which aligns with that the high end of that number that I mentioned previously, the 15 to 20%. So what we saw when we plugged that in is that there was significant flow attenuation in those design storm events. So we ran it for the 10, 25, and 100-year, 24-hour design storm events, pre and post, to see what it did downstream. So what we saw is that stages in Little Cow Creek and Turnbull Hammock actually came down after the proposed development was constructed. So in the table here, you can see those results. There's two current discharge locations where that area discharges to that go into Little Cow Creek under I-95. That's where it currently, under existing conditions, that area flows to and goes into the city, into Little Cow Creek, and into Turnbull Hammock. So the chart, the top of the chart shows the comparison in flows on the north discharge location, and the bottom shows the south discharge location. So and that is showing the peak flow rate coming out of the proposed development that would be going under I-95 under proposed conditions. So there's existing and proposed and difference, and there's a percent difference. So what we're showing is that once the development is constructed, there would actually be pretty significant decreases in flow coming from that area into Little Cow Creek and into Turnbull Hammock. You know, some of them are a 50% reduction in the 25 and 100-year events, which is significant. And then the next slide shows kind of on the left, you've got the existing conditions. Or I guess, sorry, this is the 25-year results. And on the right, you've got the 100-year results. So it's hard to see the numbers on there, but the nodes, little blue points, are labeled with the stage differences for those two different storm events. And you can see that those are all negative numbers in Little Cow Creek and Turnbull Hammock. So based on the modeling, taking that proposed development, plugging it in, comparing it to existing conditions, this is what we're seeing.
I'd like Mr. Deering Park to come back up. Is it on?
The screen, it's on. Yeah.
I've been paying attention to your stormwater drainage very much, so you know that. And how much are you required to have on the property you're developing?
In terms of total?
How many total acres?
Total acres, typically it would be about 15%. And what we're providing is 21%.
You're over adjusting for the a common flow. So
yeah, we've on both the attenuation, which is the storage, and on the water quality side.
And plan B would be Little Cow Creek going into Turnbull Hammock, which goes into the headwaters of the Indian River. Correct.
Goes south, yes.
And then plan C, if I'm not mistaken, goes into Crane Swamp, which eventually goes into the St. John's River.
Correct.
Okay. So you've not only do you have above and beyond the water storage that you're required to have, you also have plan B and plan C.
Correct. Correct.
And for the people that are in Edgewater that are worried about the new development flooding, I mean, think about it. You got 95. You're going to tell me you're going to run the water over 95? Water don't flow uphill. Flow downhill. And then between us and that, we have the Turnbull Hammock, which makes a deep V, which eventually goes into the Indian River. So I wanted to address those people. I've heard them complain, oh, we're going to flood. Well, I've paid a bunch of attention to it, and I don't see how that's going to happen. Thank you, sir.
Who would like to go next?
Well, I ain't done. That was the west side.
Open the council comments.
I'll go last, if that's all right.
Mr. Mayor, if I could, just in layman's terms. So this software, we can model all new development. So we obviously asked the engineers to model the upcoming development at Deering Park to see what it looks like in regard to stormwater and see where their water is going and if it was reducing the amount that is shedding their property. Also with the other project, the Live Local project in front of Edgewater Landing, we were able to model that to ensure that if that project moves forward, they're meeting our new very stringent standard. So this great model is going to be a great use in the future.
Great, thank you.
I have a question. For phase one, the pump stations that will be put on the existing lakes, will we have to acquire any property to run the pipes under? Because the pipes, it'll eventually, the pond will be pumped down, run through pipes, and then exiting out at the Indian River Lagoon. Will we have to acquire properties along that route to get there?
So ultimately, a formal route study will need to occur. But what we tried to do was use public right-of-ways or easements where we could to see if we could do that. And for the most part, we were able to do that. At the ultimate outfall from US 1 to the river, that is a city-owned piece of property. So we try to use either a city-owned piece of property right-of-way or an easement. So I think it can be done, you know, through right-of-ways and easements.
Thank you.
You done? Who's next?
It doesn't matter. Just go ahead and speak.
Okay.
I'll have to take turns.
I have a couple questions. So Deering Park's will pull 20% away from us, 18-20%. Less likely of them flowing towards us, which water does flow under downhill. We couldn't get onto our evacuation route on I-95 during Hurricane Ian because 442 goes under it. So how is the water going to get to us under 442? It's going to come under 95 by 442. I believe they have plans.
It already,
were those plans put in the modeling? Or?
I guess the water already comes under I-95.
Yes.
So the 400, the 20% is the 400 acres of stormwater pond. So what that ends up doing is holding back a whole bunch of water basically in those ponds and reducing the amount of flow that's going under I-95
right
in that direction from west to east.
So I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you. And these dollars, we got to keep remembering as taxpayers that when you're talking about these dollars, that's at 2025 dollars.
Correct.
It's 210 million. In 10 years could be 250 million. We're battling inflation. The longer we take to pull a trigger every time, like we were told a Seagate was like 5 million. If we make the purchase order now, in 3 years, it could be, who knows what inflation is going to be. But I hate to be critical. I understand you guys put a lot of data into your modeling, but I'm an IT guy, and what you put in is important, because when I hear modeling, I think of these spaghetti models in the hurricanes where there's 50 lines and one of them hits right. So I'm trusting that. I think Ryan said that we have data back to several hurricanes that you guys entered into here. Some of our major hurricanes, that data and height was put into here, into this modeling. Because the word modeling makes me nervous.
Yeah.
Are you right or aren't you?
So I think the data that Ryan was referring to was photographs and measurements of flooding that occurred during Hurricane Milton. And then Milton in the September 14th rainstorm event. So that wasn't anything that got put into the model. What we put into the model are rainfall distributions that we get from the Water Management District and other rainfall gauges that are available in the area. So then we use those rainfall data, plug them into the model, simulate the model, and then we see how it compares to the information that Ryan had for us. So if we're saying that Ryan's data was saying there's a foot of flooding on this road, we model it using the rainfall data, and we check that the model is showing that, you know, there's about a foot of flooding in that area. So that's how we verify.
I like seeing that you had pictures of where it was taken to.
Correct.
Yeah. And that's all I have. My other 2 points are for staff. One thing is the spot that Mr. Martin talked about. I've been down there with him and Diesel. The end of the 18th Street Canal. I think Mr. Maroney said something about we were waiting for permission to clean that out, which I don't understand. That's our out. That's not a natural sandbar. That's our output over years and years and years of our floods come down that funnel. That's still there. You could walk out there. That wasn't there. I remember we used to be able to go. I wouldn't recommend it, but you can go up to your chest and out there now, and now you can walk across it. Is there any update on us being able to get that out of there? Because that's like a cork halfway in a bottle of wine, and that's got to be part of our problem. That's low-hanging fruit, I believe.
Yeah, it's a priority. We submitted the permits in September. We already have the design work done by the engineering firm. I have myself and the mayor written letters to both entities, the Army Corps of Engineers, Florida Department of Environment Protection, St. John's Water Management District. I sent an email to our representative, state representative. I spoke to a guy, an individual at a FIND meeting with the Army Corps. He responded today via email and has moved it up the ladder to escalate the project to see if we can get expedited permitting. But it's something we need a permit to do to dredge the waterway.
And the state,
I'm trying to expedite as fast as I can.
It doesn't make sense. It's our garbage, and it's piling up. You think they'd be yelling at us to get it out of there, but they want to protect it. The only other thing that I'm seeing in this whole thing, it is a lot of money. It's over a large amount of time. So I guess we can get there. And now that we have this study, we can go to the federal government and get some better money than the state's been able to give us. But if we're the only ones to do this, I'm watching the surrounding areas, and we seem to be the only ones wanting to do anything. If New Smyrna doesn't join in and control their water, and the county doesn't join in to control their water, we're just going to be everybody's water storage area. And they'll probably be up there in Port Orange and New Smyrna Beach. Hey, yeah, we don't got to do nothing. They got plenty of room for water now. So to all you other areas surrounding us, please do something to help us out here. This is Volusia County. Let's all get together and figure this out, because I don't want to be the only municipality that like wants to do anything about this. Thank you guys for your explanation of everything.
So we've personally also taken State Representative Chase Tremont down to that site as well, who has expressed concern with that and said he would do anything he possibly can to help with that issue. He's always one phone call away. I'll go ahead and start. The very first thing I did as mayor was Glenn Irby and I sat down and we expressed, you know, how important this was, not only on a, you know, a citywide level to know our problematic areas, and we've gotten worse since then. If we had stronger management in the past, we would have continued this study each and every year and knew what we had to do. But anyway, that's here nor there. The very first question that I receive at a state level, and when I'm talking to our federal representatives, Corey Mills, about 2 years ago when I was first elected, came and had a private meeting with myself along with staff at City Manager Irby at that time. And one of the very first questions he asked was, do you have your stormwater master plan updated and ready to present to me so I can go get us some funding? He said, well, not necessarily. So here we are. We can't go backwards. We can only go forward. It's a lot of money, absolutely. I think most of us were expecting that. My guess was $500 million. I said that openly several times, so it's a little bit less than that. I'm proud that we have this plan back. We need to work towards funding. The city manager and myself, hopefully with council support, are talking about how we can get some more federal resources involved to receive state funding. You look at Daytona Beach. They were able to get the Army Corps of Engineers involved because they had a stormwater master plan back. A lot of residents in our area here said, well, why did the city of Port Orange receive $6 million for Transform 386 money and we didn't? That was part of their stormwater master plan. This is very important that we have this done for funding resources and so that we know our problematic areas and what we need to do and how we can plan moving forward in the future. I'm glad it's back. I think that there is a lot of low-hanging fruit that several residents, such as Mr. Martin, has talked about in our area for years. The G2, G11 canal, that's almost at the construction stage. First of the year, that's great. We received that grant several years ago. That'll really be a plus. Not only that, I think that we can put culverts underneath Walker Road for strategic less amount of money, and we can potentially receive grants there. There's several things that this stormwater master plan came back with, I think, that is low-hanging fruit that staff has been working on and talking on that we can really make a difference. So I'm very glad on a funding level that we have this plan back and that moving forward, you know, they did models all the way back to 1953. I was concerned when they said that the elevation, LIDAR, digital elevation models from 2018, but they addressed that. They went to each development and really seeing how that affects the area on a model level. So I'm impressed. I'm very glad that we have it back. And we need to keep it up to date moving forward so that we don't have to pay a large sum all at once and we're not at $500 million instead of $10 million. That's just my thoughts.
I do have a couple comments. Oh, am I? Okay, yes. There we go. I'm just gonna hold it. So you said, a lot of it is when we have to do this, these plans is because that we can say we know, like a lot of these things are things we knew we were going to come back. We knew a lot of this stuff needed to be widened and dredged. And I think it was in that we've talked, I mean, we were asking for pumps from Irby 3 years ago. And so, I mean, a lot of these things are things that we knew, but we needed to have somebody else because that's how the state works. A lot of times they want us to pay somebody else to tell them the thing that we already know so we can ask for money from somebody else. So I just wanted to reiterate that again because a lot of these things are things we knew we were going to come back with, but we had to see it in writing from somebody the state would listen to when we ask for the money for it. The one thing, I mean, I have concerns about anything with a property acquisition. I'm not for anything with that, but it was my understanding that if we implement phase one, that there's parts of phase two they don't believe may be needed. Can I have that clarity on that because that was something that I wasn't with, but if phase one is implemented, and moving forward, that alleviates the issue and fixes a lot of the problems, then we wouldn't necessarily need to do a lot of those things for phase two.
So phase one really addresses the 25-year return period storm to really move towards, as we were given as a goal, that 100-year return period storm. You really need the phase two implemented to provide that significant amount of storage. We could provide storage elsewhere, but other than the 30 acres within Florida Shores, that would be ideal, but there's not much options left. We're optimizing with the Massey Pond, with the Mango, with the little pond off of Willow, but those are all the available open spaces and they don't quite get to where we need to get. So we had to add the 30 acres within Florida Shores to get there, to remove a significant number of the homes.
And then I did want to, this really isn't a question, this is more so if just as a comment kind of, because it was put on several
slides, and I just kind of wanted to highlight this, because there's so many times when we talk about things and we keep getting told that a lot of this development isn't causing any of the issues, and it's all these other issues in the shores, but on several sides you've got flooding drivers, increasing impervious area as Florida Shores has experienced the infill, and then loss of surface storage as Florida Shores has experienced the infill. So we're just, that's on so many slides, and there's so many times that everybody is coming and saying that, oh, there's no proof of this, but you're showing it as a flooding driver in several locations, and I appreciate that. So sorry, I wanted to highlight that, because I saw it the first time, I was like, they actually put that in writing? And then sure enough, on several slides, it's showing that the impervious has causing an issues, and so is the loss of the storage from all the infill. Thank you.
Ms. Belbo, where are you going to go?
I agree with you.
Huh? Okay.
That reminds me. I raised my hand. Sorry. I could just talk over you if you want. That reminded me of one thing. It might involve Ryan. I don't know if it was just New Smyrna or if it's going to be everybody, but weren't some of the residents told that they have a certain amount of time to get their building to within a certain code? And can that happen here? And would that force people to have to like either put a lot of money into like pretty much redoing their whole house or selling? You know the instance I'm talking about? I think it was New Smyrna was given a time frame where they have to get to a certain point.
So Ryan Solstice, Development Services Director, what you're probably referring to is what happened after Milton is the repetitive loss provisions. Surprisingly, Florida Shores is not actually considered a 100-year flood zone. So that repetitive loss provision isn't in effect for Florida Shores. It only affects the 100-year flood zone or greater. And so a lot of those were being triggered because there are a lot of properties that are located in the 100-year flood zone in many of our other municipalities. And they, part of that CRS rating system to get the FEMA flood insurance discount is that you enforce repetitive loss. And so when that did trigger, when people had that 50% damage to their structure, the assessed value, then it triggers that improvement where you have to then lift your house. You're welcome.
To address the east side, I addressed the west side. The east side, gentlemen, that report was fantastic. You did not leave out anything. I'm just so impressed with what you had there. How long did it take y'all to do this study?
About a year, 15 months.
No, to do the study, the whole study, the water flow and I'm just interested. How long it took you to do it?
I believe we started in August or September of last year.
Okay.
So. Hold on, 15.
But you can tell you spent a lot of time. And but my problem is, where are we going to get $450 million? This is a little city. And we done pissed the state off by suing them over 180. So, you know, are they going to give us money? I don't know about that. But, and one of the residents got up here and said, we need to do this now. We were very, very lucky, very, very fortunate that we didn't have any hurricanes last year. But if we don't, and we have put our workers out there on the street, and buddy, they have band-aided everything they could band-aid. I don't think they can make any more band-aids than what they have done. I mean, they have dug, cleaned, and just I am impressed with what we've accomplished to keep the water out of the houses on this last flood, especially on the 30th Street. Silver Palm Ditch, which goes out in the hammock. Now, do we have a slide of the south, the southwest part of the hammock? I mean, of the Florida Shores. Can somebody, the southwest part of the Florida Shores? Mr. Mayor, you were there. The wettest part of the Florida Shores, if I remember right, was the southernmost part and the middle part. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I'd say the middle part of Florida Shores, 16 to 26.
To put another Band-Aid is what I would like to start immediately is they've got a good idea on the outflow along 20th Street to go to the Indian River, which would take the water out of the middle of Florida Shores. And yes, that's what I want. Now down here on the southwest corner, there's a piece of property that I would love to buy and run a ditch out into the hammock. We already have permission that the county bought that property and the state, they gave it to the state, and we've got permission to empty our water into it, our drainage. And I'd love to see, and on that piece of property, we could dig a big, huge bar pit, which, you know, would hold water there, but then the rest of the water could, because we only have two natural outflows. We've got the Indian River, and we got Turnbull Hammock. We're lucky to have Turnbull Hammock on our west side. And so that's the two primary things that would help, I think would help before we get into hurricane season next year.
I certainly agree with you. Here's what I'm going to propose and think is we just got this back. I think we all need to digest it, including management. But what we don't want is, oh, well, it's $216 million. Let's just keep it on the shelf. We're never going to find that money, which I think we can. There's multiple ways that have been discussed. But, Mr. Manager, not to put you on the spot, but we've done this in the past, and, you know, we said once a quarter, but I think we had an issue with the clerk's office. But would it be possible that you could get, we could digest this, we could see if there are any already funding options? I think the Valco Road project that's already permitted and here, I think that could potentially be low-hanging fruit that we could fund the culvert project. So could we digest this after the holidays? Could you potentially, in your city manager report with Bridget, I don't know if she's here or not, sit down with Bridget, see if there are any ways to fund this and give a once a quarter update so we don't just put this on the shelf. Not to put you on the spot, but I think that this is a lot to digest tonight. But Mr. Thomas, I think that's a great idea, absolutely. But I don't want this plan just to die like it has before in the past.
The longer you put it off, the more expensive it's going to get.
There's
no question about that. You're right on the head about that. So I would like to go with your plan, and I'd like to see the Band-Aid, you know, another Band-Aid. So
of course, I tend to move pretty quickly. So everything in my power that I can do to get things done quickly, I'm going
right.
to. Even in their plan already, we've already removed some of the crossovers on the Silver Palm Canal to increase flow. That was a low-hanging fruit and very inexpensive. So whatever staff can do, and we have to digest this as well, and I'll have a report for you in the January meeting.
In the January meeting, wow, you do move quick.
So well, hopefully, it is the holidays, so I'll have some updates in January, and then give me till February to have a
but let's just
comprehensive plan.
Go ahead with consensus and with the city manager report, not to put you on the spot, but can we have an update every quarter and have staff go ahead and digest it if you need more than January?
Yes, I can give you, of course. Yeah,
right.
Of course.
Is that okay with the council?
Perfect.
Are there any other questions from the council? I'm looking forward to seeing ways that we can fund the low-hanging fruit and how we can federally get involved, like I say, to Daytona Beach, Port Orange. They got funding right away pretty much from the county, federal, and state because they had this done. So looking forward to moving forward. I think that there are low-hanging fruit that we can fund. So we will be back, I guess, once a quarter. Digest this. You got a lot to digest and a lot to talk about with Mr. Laherty. Any further comments? Okay, we are adjourned till our city council meeting at 6 o'clock.